Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. Well, it's about time. That's the reaction a lot of North Carolinians have had to a recent order from a Superior Court judge in the 25-year-old Leandro lawsuit directing state legislators to fund an initial $1.75 billion installment toward bringing the state's broken public school system into compliance with the state constitution. Of course, as we discussed in our previous interview with Representative Ashton Wheeler Clements, Republican legislative leaders have thus far refused to comply with the order, a step that's putting the state on course for a constitutional showdown between the legislative and judicial branches. Recently, in an effort to better understand the judge's order, what it would do, and why it was so necessary, I talked to an advocate who spent much of his career closely monitoring the case, the director of the North Carolina Justice Center's Education and Law Project, attorney Matt Ellenwood.
Well, Matt Ellenwood, welcome back to News and Views. Good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob. It's good to be here.
So a momentous time in public education in North Carolina. Last week, Judge David Lee issued his long-awaited order in the Leandro school funding case, directing the General Assembly to take some of the action that has been put off now for close to a quarter of a century. The General Assembly passed a budget version, or is in the process of passing a version of the budget as we record this, that maybe does some of that. But talk to us about the order and remind our listeners why this has been made necessary.
Sure. I've been really fortunate to work with this Every Child NC coalition that's made up of the at-risk groups that really are at issue in Leandro, the students who had their constitutional rights violated over the decades that this case has been going on. And that includes people living in low-income communities like the original counties that brought the Leandro suit, Hoke and Halifax, Robeson. And then also there's a at-risk student groups that have been identified over the years of the case who are falling further and further behind. And certainly that's the case during the pandemic, but it's not just low-income students, it's also English learners, students with disabilities. They're located in all of the communities across the state. They're facing additional barriers, educational opportunities. So this group really looked at the WestEd plan that was developed as part of the case, which we think is a really great plan. It was really amazing the way it was developed, where they actually went out into the state and talked to teachers and principals and administrators and said, what are the resources that are missing in our schools right now that are preventing you from being able to provide all students with the opportunity to get a sound basic education, the standard that was developed in the Leandro case? And so all of the recommendations in that plan are based on real things that are really happening in our schools and shortfalls that have been identified by people across North Carolina who work directly with students and know our system the best. We were also able to take those recommendations and share them with these community groups that I mentioned, to ensure that it's really responsive to the needs of people who have been most directly impacted. And I think that's one problem with the case is it's a lot of times been seen as this high level state case involving the entire system. How do we connect that to the resources in individual communities, particularly for students who have their rights, again, most clearly violated? And we've been really heartened to see that the recommendations in there are the types of things that people really want to see, that we need to have access to pre-kindergarten for all at-risk children. We want to have highly qualified teachers and principals in all of our classrooms and come up with a system that's going to help recruit them to schools that are where we have more teacher turnover or more difficulty recruiting. You know, some of the hard to staff subjects that we've seen have faced shortfalls recently, students with disabilities, math, science, where we've got people kind of really struggling to fill those spots across the state. There's some changes to the way that the students with disabilities allotment is funded. That's always been an underfunded allotment that is really important. Same thing with for English learners. And there's been some pretty important changes to the way we do professional development that are proposed. And a lot of it is around staffing, though. We've had these well-documented shortfalls of nurses, counselors, therapists. So a lot of people have been able to rally around these recommendations. You know, if you're a group that works on school discipline problems, a lot of those groups want to have more counselors so that rather than just suspending and expelling kids, we can provide them with different supports to deal with student misbehavior in a positive way that prevents it from happening again. So there's a lot in this plan. It's a broad plan, but it's because the system is pre-K through college system with a lot of pieces that people are operating, people are experiencing their entire lives in the system, or, you know, big, really formative years. It's a big deal to have this comprehensive plan that we have, and to have it finally be funded is really an amazing development. And it was met with a mixture of, I think, excitement and relief, because we have not had a plan as a state, even though we've had this ruling on the books with one from the Supreme Court for at least 17 years. Even in that whole time, we've never come up with a plan for what we're going to do to remedy this constitutional deficiency until now. And then there's been resistance to funding that plan. And that's been the main barrier to implementing the plan since it was developed, you know, a couple of years ago. Now that's the barrier that the judge was addressing.
So we've got this constitutional right to have an opportunity to receive a sound basic education in North Carolina. We know that for years and years, despite there being this constitutional right, our state lawmakers have not been appropriating the funds to make it possible, make it a reality. The judge overseeing the case has finally said, that's it. Everybody out of the pool. Let's get this done. He's brought together this amazing detailed study. He has now directed the General Assembly to begin the process of funding the recommendations in this study. The first order calls for something on the order of, as I understand it, $1.75 billion. Am I right about that?
And yeah, that's spread over 2 years.
Right. Over the first 2 years of what would be ultimately like a plan that takes us through the end of the decade, effectively. The General Assembly has responded in a couple of ways. First, they have demeaned the judge, called him a rogue judge, said he has no right to do this at all. And then they have passed their version of a state budget in recent days that maybe does some of what is recommended in the report, but not in the kind of comprehensive way, and certainly not to the full funding levels that the judge has directed. Is that sort of a fair assessment of where things stand now? And now we have to figure out where we go next?
And that's been the sort of maddening question around this the whole time, is kind of why not? The General Assembly's never sat down and looked at this plan. We really would have liked to have seen it. You know, let's look at the WestEd report at the education committees that they have at the legislature and do a deep dive and go through it line by line and say, what is it in here that you don't think our students ought to have? Is it that we don't need to have a nurse in every school? Is it that we don't need to have pre-K for at-risk children? Is it that we don't need to have highly qualified teachers and principals? What is the resistance to what's in this plan, other than a lot of the responses have been kind of around it, who has the power to do what?
Right.
But what's more important, I think, is what is it that we expect out of our education system in terms of the opportunities it provides for children, and how, and how are we going to uphold what's in the Constitution? I mean, I think that's another thing that you don't want to forget about. One reason why I think North Carolina was so well known for its education system in the 90s and early 2000s is just because it's always been a priority. Going back to the time that the Constitution's, there have been a couple of different versions of it, but all of them have really put education as a really important right. You know, most of our rights come from the U.S. Constitution, but the right to education lives in the various state constitutions. If not the most important fundamental right that lives in the state constitutions, it might be the only one. In North Carolina, particularly, we've always had a really strong constitutional language on the right to an education. And I think that served the state really well for many years as it grew. We had a really strong system that was really held up nationally, from a strong pre-K system, strong community college and university system, and a K-12 system that was producing really strong gains on things like the National Assessment for Educational Progress in the 90s and 2000s is really one of the top states. And then we had this backwards turn over the last decade where we've really cut a lot of the strengths of that. And we've seen it have an impact on results for children, where achievement gaps, opportunity gaps have grown over that period at some of the fastest rates in the country, after years of slow and steady, frustratingly slow progress, but at least progress on these different test score measures and things. We've actually begun to see some of them are moving backwards in the wrong direction, and the rest have just sort of tabled off and they're flat. After that progress, we're starting to see it show up in our classroom. So no one's really arguing that the system is constitutional. No one's arguing that we're meeting students' needs. It's a question of what are we going to do, if anything, about that. But this ruling was met really with a sigh of relief and a celebration. I think, you know, some frustration of not being clear what comes next. But I think the fact that after all this time, and particularly all the problems that have been piled on schools and the pandemic as well, the stresses that are being put on families and children, this was met with a lot of excitement and some relief that someone is out there enforcing the rights that are in the state constitution as it pertains to at-risk children.
It is really encouraging. I guess there's the concern that, particularly in the Republican leadership of the General Assembly, they're saying, you can't make us, you can't tell us what to do. No judge is going to tell the legislature to appropriate money. But of course, this begs the question, what if the General Assembly just chose not to have a public education system? The Constitution says we have to have one. So one presumes that a judge would be in their rights to direct the General Assembly to do what the Constitution says. And it's hard to see how that really differs from this situation that we're discussing right now.
Right. I mean, to adopt that position means that there's no purpose to having this written in the Constitution, essentially. I mean, the Constitution in North Carolina was approved by the voters too, but that's sort of the purpose of the Constitution, is that no one's above it, that no General Assembly can do things that fall below the constitutional floor, particularly when it comes to education, which I think is the most important right that's enumerated in the state constitution, and that we have really strong constitutional language about the importance of having an education system. It actually says that wherein equal educational opportunities are provided for all children. I don't think anyone would argue that that's happened. I think the other kind of unusual fact of the what happened with this ruling is when you look at cases around in other states that are similar to this, it's very unusual to just have money sitting around the way North Carolina does. That the legislature sort of went out of its way to not spend this money. We have billions of dollars of unappropriated revenue because revenue collections came in better than expected in the pandemic, and we got a lot of federal money in recent years. That's the unusual fact in this particular case, is that we have all this unspent money. So we're kind of going out of our way to not fund this plan. We'd rather have the money be unspent. Judge was able to take this step that seems unusual, because it's unusual to have money just sitting around like that.
In the budget that the General Assembly is about to send to Governor Cooper as we record this, they actually cut taxes further in the years to come, even though our taxes have been cut repeatedly in the last decade, are among the lowest in the country in many respects. And yet they would be cut still further, which would presumably inhibit their ability to comply with the WestEd plan and the order going forward.
Yes, I'm very concerned about that. You know, I think that you alluded to it. This is an 8-year plan that takes us right up to the end of this decade. And in some ways, it scales up over time, and you have to keep the investments from the early years. So in some ways, the easiest years to do are years 1, 2, and 3. This is actually a pretty watered down version actually already of what's been recommended. You know, the real commitment comes later. And at the same time as we're only funding 50% of the kind of easy part in the conference budget, or not even 50% in year two, we're also hamstringing our ability to fund the bigger investments that need to come down the line. And just to be clear, if we were to fund the whole plan all the way out into 8 year, that would only take us to about the national average in terms of school funding efforts. That's like the percentage of our gross domestic product that we've invest in our education system. It's a good way to kind of compare different states. So even though it's billions of dollars we're talking about, it's not some extravagant system that we're talking about. It's bringing it to about the national average.
Well, I believe I saw the statistic that when you look at a state's spending on effort, this may even be something that the Education and Law Project produced, we're something like second from the bottom in the country when it comes to what we spend on education as a share of our total economy. Virtually every other state in the country is spending more of what they've got on education than North Carolina.
Yeah, that's right. That's from a recent report by the Education Law Center. It's a national group that looks at all the different states' funding formulas and determines their level of sort of fairness. Are they distributing it equitably? And we got an F in the second lowest grade on school funding effort. So this year, where there's money just sort of sitting around unspent, the problem going forward, we aren't always going to have this situation where revenues come in higher than expected and we have the federal government's help. So, you know, as we move forward, that lack of effort on the state level is going to become a real big problem in funding this plan. I don't even know if we would be able to fund it at just the current levels of these years that we're looking at, years 1, 2, and 3 of the plan going forward with these cuts, because we'd have less revenue available. So not to mention the increased investments that are going to be needed to get out to year 8 and finally get up to, again, just to about average. That's the goal right now.
We're coming to the end of our time with Matt Ellenwood, who's the director of the Education and Law Project at the North Carolina Justice Center. We're talking about the Leandro court case, the order that the judge has issued in the case, and the General Assembly's response. So, Matt, I guess the 64-something million, thousand, billion-dollar question is, what's next? If the General Assembly is not going to abide by the judge's order, where do we go from here? Will he take action? Will we have further appeals? That seems probably likely.
Yeah, well, in a way, he bypassed the General Assembly by making the order directly. I mean, they have 30 days to comply, and I guess this conference budget shows the extent of their compliance, which is about half. But since the plan lays out the constitutional minimum, the judge will find that this doesn't comply with the constitutional minimum, because this is only half of that. And I mentioned the comprehensive nature of our education system. It doesn't work where you can just fund pieces and leave pieces completely underfunded. So then there's the questions about, will the General Assembly want to intervene in the case? They passed a law in 2017 that said that they can intervene as of right in any case where the state is the named defendant like this. so they could intervene and appoint their own attorneys. This was, you know, partially that they wanted to have be able to have their own attorneys instead of the attorney general representing them in different cases. They don't have that right now. They haven't intervened yet. So they could do that and appeal, or they could challenge the, do something. This is where it would get a little complicated. If they might challenge the treasurer or controller's actions in releasing the funds or something like that. So it's pretty unclear, but I think it keeps coming back to the kind of why, like, how hard do you want to fight to avoid investing in our education system at a time when our families and kids are coming out of a pandemic that's put a lot of burdens on this system, a system that was already highly burdened before this. So I think the pandemic exposed a lot of things about a lot of our institutions. This was already starting to happen before this, where we're having trouble filling certain, a lot of teaching positions, you know, particularly around special education, some of the STEM subjects. We were already seeing, like I said, the declines in student performance and the growth of the opportunity gaps, but that's all been supercharged by the pandemic. So how hard do you want to fight to avoid investing in this system that supports still, you know, over 80% of our kids and families? It's the best thing going in a lot of communities. It's hub for a lot of activities in our communities across the state. How hard do you want to fight to avoid investing in this system? And is it worth it, particularly at a time when we actually do have funding available to invest in it?
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed that they finally wake up and do the right thing. Thank you for your advocacy, Matt, to keep pushing them in that direction. And we'll look forward to an update early in the new year, in all likelihood. We'll talk to you real soon. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Rob.
Coming up next, we'll hear about an upcoming WRAL-TV program that takes a look at the promising work of the Duke Human Vaccine Institute. Stay with us.